And I think there is this perceived risk that is not reality when it comes to these properties. I really do believe that. It's like they're different, so therefore perceived as risky, whereas in reality, they're less risky because they're different.
Welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, where we interview voices shaping the real estate industry, entrepreneurship, and our world. On today's podcast, we sit down with Ben Wolf. Ben, also known on Twitter as Unique Stays Guy, is co-founder at Guanera, Oasis, and Blink Hospitality. He's a leading entrepreneur in the alternative lodging real estate industry, and he's a major voice in the movement for reshaping hospitality. On the podcast, we discuss the power of unique products, methods to develop strong brands, and the future of the hospitality industry. If you're an entrepreneur or a real estate investor, today's podcast and discussion is well worth a listen. Ben, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me on, Gordon.
So why hospitality?
I think ever since I was young, I enjoyed hosting people and sort of showing them a good time and helping create one-of-a-kind experiences. And that could be anything from a house party to a massive, you know, 30-person group trip to Dominican Republic, where we get this insane villa and infinity pool and, you know, an amazing group of people together. So I've done a variety of different things. College, I had a events and promotions company, did some of that in New York City as well. And then from there, kind of got into more of the real estate side of it with Airbnb and now Unique Stays and Landscape Hotels.
And so what got you started in the whole world of hospitality? Was it like a great experience? Was it the industry? Like what brought you in?
So I think what brought me into the real estate side is I actually have a co-founder now, Jesse, who runs all of our social media, content marketing, digital marketing more broadly, as well as revenue management. And he had this upstart Airbnb management company back in like 2014. And me and my roommate at the time had this big 2,000 square foot loft in Flatiron, and it was the Super Bowl. And we were thinking about Airbnb-ing for the Super Bowl, which ended up being a bust. It was like -5 or something, and nobody cared. But that introduced me to Jesse, and then started getting the wheels turning around getting into Airbnb and short-term rentals. And, you know, then that progressed into now hotels.
There's a lot going on in the Airbnb space, right, relative to hotels. And do you think there's an advantage that you started off kind of Airbnb-ing and moved into hotels versus the hotels that are starting the Airbnb process?
100%. I mean, I think there's a massive groupthink issue going on in hotels and in that hospitality world for many decades now. They all went to the same schools. They all, you know, read from the same books and listen to the same people. And there's this idea that we've been doing it the same way for a long time, and that's the right way to do it. And we want to turn that on its head. There's been very little innovation, in my view, in the hotel space in, I mean, call it probably 50 plus years. Biggest innovation being loyalty rewards points. I mean, you know, that doesn't sort of excite me. I know they've done well with that and certainly brought in the business traveler in a much bigger way. But when it comes to, you know, leisure travel or one-of-a-kind experiences, shareability with this new age of social media where everybody just wants to share the most amazing things that they're doing. It just feels like the bread and butter, heads in beds, big box hotels have kind of missed the mark and they're not reinventing fast enough.
So where do you think the good and the bad is ultimately of your traditional model? So, let's start with the good. What is it that big hotel chains do right?
I think they're good at operations. I think they're good at controlling and projecting costs and you know, budgets and P&Ls. I think they're pretty good on that side of things. I think they're pretty good at providing a relatively consistent experience and providing comfort. And I think all of that is typically they're in good locations. Right, at least in terms of urban. So all that I think is great for the business traveler and the traveler that, you know, maybe is less discerning about where they stay. And it's more about, you know, what they're doing outside of the stay. We believe that the modern traveler cares a whole lot about where they're staying, and that may actually, they'd be happy to pay double to stay in an amazing space and maybe spend less in other areas. So that's what we're seeing more and more of. And so those are things I think that the hotel, sort of long-standing hotel big brands have done and continue to do. I think where they miss the mark a little bit is, we believe that the feeling of hospitality in these big brand hotels, it feels very transactional, right? It feels like you're a number on a spreadsheet. And going back to that loyalty rewards points side of things, right? This big innovation, this, you know, trying to kind of give back, I guess, in a way, but it's really just to keep you having switching costs, right, to other big brands is really what it is. And what's more transactional than you spent a lot of money at my hotel, so I'm going to treat you better because you have. So that, I mean, that's pretty transactional, right? So for us, it's how can we be collaborative with our guests? How can we be sort of co-pilots on the journey with them and provide this one-of-a-kind experience and memory that's highly shareable? And that's what we're aiming to deliver with them. And whether you're, you know, you've stayed with us for your first time or this is your sixth time, hopefully we're treating you the same way and have that same goal of making sure you have a one-of-a-kind experience.
And so where does that collaboration start? Does it start like on social media? When you enter a physical location, can you kind of walk us through that process?
Yeah, so I would say it typically does start on social media, or maybe your friend shares you with the property, takes some of their own photos. Typically, that's on social media, but it could be text, I guess, or something else. And we think that it can start even pre-open, right? So we're now doing what's called building in public and sharing everything from capital raising to architectural renderings and designs to the build process to the launch to our numbers. So we're kind of sharing everything. And I believe that that creates a fan base years before you open. And there's an emotional connection to the founder, to the team, as well as to the property, because, you know, we've seen this time and time again that people today, they love people. Maybe they like brands and they typically detest businesses. So, you know, if you look at like, Steve Jobs when he was alive and now Tim Cook or, Brian Chesky, you know, or Elon Musk, right? Their personal followings are orders of magnitude higher than their brand's followings. And when there's a big announcement to release, typically they're doing it and their announcement carries a lot more weight than the brand announcement. So, you know, I think that's just one example of how, having sort of a connection to the founder and the team is super important. And today's consumer, you know, really latches onto that. Another example, more building in public focused. If you look at Devin Lurup, so he created the Pacific Bin container home, Airbnb out in the middle of nowhere, Washington, basically. It's a beautiful property, but nothing around. And he's amassed well over 1 million followers across socials by documenting the entire process along the way. And it's one Airbnb, right? It's not this, you know, critically acclaimed world famous hotel. And he's amassed more followers than most really nice hotels have.
So what do you think that ultimate value is for you guys? Because I know there's been plenty of folks on real estate Twitter or, real estate X, whatever you want to call it, that have built in public and that they've seen a variety of success, right? You know, you have some that are extremely successful at building and acquiring investment, some that build in public and create really a brand loyalty. Where do you see that ultimate value is for you guys?
I mean, it's all of the above, right? I mean, so for my core company, Awasi, and I'm also the founder of Onera, which I'm sure we'll talk about, a treehouse hotel in Fredericksburg, Texas, which has done really well. But my core company, Awasi, we're raising money for new projects. We're actually raising money right now for Awasi Hill Country, which is, you know, our most ambitious project yet. It has the best views that I've seen in Texas, and we're building a one-of-a-kind landscape hotel. So we're raising money for that. I'm always looking for people to add to the team for those projects, whether that's architects or designers, subcontractors. I have a GC that's kind of my core partner in these builds, and hopefully we'll just, you know, continue to build these together because he's great. So that's on the Owasi side. And then we also provide social media marketing, digital marketing, and revenue management, property management services, as well as design and development advisory. So we provide all these services, and we're constantly getting inbound because we're sharing our results. You know, our audience has a connection to me. They feel like they know me because I've been on a bunch of podcasts talking about this stuff, sharing the vulnerable things like mistakes that I've made and lessons that I've learned. So there's a connection there, and there's a trust that we have their best interest at heart. We understand what they're going through, maybe opening this new unique stays property and not knowing where to start in terms of management and marketing. So that's one piece, right? Lead generation. And then the final piece is what we were talking about before, which is a connection to the property, which builds a fan base when it comes to guests. They want to stay at the property I developed and designed because they feel a connection to me, right? And they know that I'm trying to inspire and blow away our guests, and they connect with that vision. They're enrolled in this mission of creating these shareable properties. There's so many benefits. I could go on, but those are probably the three main ones.
So I know you mentioned vulnerable mistakes. And look, I'll say this. The one thing that I think is the biggest downside with social media in general and real estate Twitter is everybody likes to talk about their success stories and nobody likes to talk about their mistakes. And anybody who's been in development or commercial real estate knows that we've made plenty of mistakes. That doesn't mean that we don't, you know, sometimes bat, you know, in the high, you know, 800s or 900s, certainly better than baseball, but we do make some mistakes. And I'm curious, what do you feel like are some of your biggest mistakes and some of the mistakes that folks really learn from via building in public?
Yeah, so happy to dive into some of the mistakes. And one thing I want to say up front is we are happy to share our mistakes, not just for our audience, but also for potential investors. Because if I can be open and honest about my mistakes, you know, investors can see that. They know where we goofed up, but they also know what we did in order to overcome that. Because I think that's more important than anything. Like if everything goes right, I don't know what you look like when things go sideways, which inevitably they do, right? So
yeah.
How are you going to respond to that? And how are you going to make lemonade out of lemons, right? So Onera Fredericksburg was my first development project, literally first. I had never built a house before that. And it was mid-COVID, you know, supply chain was messed up. You know, the subcontractor landscape was a mess. So our costs went through the roof, largely due to those things. But they also went through the roof because I picked the wrong, you know, GC group. Right. I had a great designer architecture firm that designed these amazing units that we also had build them. And in hindsight, I should have went with the GC that I'm working with now, who comes in on time and on budget, was realistic about the budget. You know, they showed the other firm showed me a budget I wanted to see, and it was more in line with my delusional expectations. Whereas the GC that I work with now showed a budget that was probably 40% higher. But I believe now he would have hit that. Alternatively, I went with the cheaper bid and they ended up going, and it wasn't a hard bid, right? It was cost plus. That's what everybody was doing at the time, COVID with COVID numbers going crazy. And, you know, what they put in front of me at first, we basically doubled it. And, you know, even when we had a tighter budget, we were still, you know, coming in 50% above. So that was a big mistake. Learned from that, raised some bridge debt, you know, to cover the difference. And thankfully, we came out the gate with very high ADRs, you know, very high occupancies, just high revenues out the gate, which, you know, really helped to kind of overcome some of those mistakes. And that's because we went all in on creating this one of a kind experience and being the best in the market. So we opened to, you know, $500 plus ADRs. Some of our units were over $600. And our occupancies were in the mid to high 80s, if not low 90s. So, you know, that was kind of overcoming, you know, some of those cost hurdles. One other thing related to that build, we sourced a bunch of our products, structures, I guess you would say, from manufacturers in China. And I had never sourced from China before. We were working with a broker. We thought that broker was handling the quality control and the boots on the ground and making sure that what we were getting is what we ordered. And that was very far from the case. So we you know, we're trying to save a couple hundred grand, and it ended up costing us, you know, costing us like double that plus between the delays that we had, the retrofitting that we had to do of the units, because a lot of the parts came, you know, incorrect. Some were even just the entirely wrong size. One of our units, we had footings poured, and the product that we got was like 2 feet in diameter shorter than, or, you know, smaller than what we had ordered. So, you know, had to go about, okay, what are we going to put on these piers that had been poured? And we figured out a way to disguise it with plants. But yeah, I mean, we made all the mistakes in the book. But thankfully we invested where it counted, and we went all in on, we're going to be, you know, the coolest game in town, right? The most unique, exciting, novel treehouse hotel in the Texas Hill Country. And I think we also benefit from, you know, I don't know, if you live in Texas, there you can get to like mediocre beaches within a few hours. If you live in Central Texas, you can go out to West Texas. It's like 6 hours away. You can get to Mexico, similar distance. And there's, you know, four nice cities, but there's not what there is to do in California, or if you live in New York, right? There's not the same extent of attractions and exciting different things to do. So if we can provide that, there is this massive captive audience with disposable income that want to go and spend their money to have amazing experiences.
How did you dial in on that like amazing experience idea? Because look, there's so many folks out there that are trying to go and create, you know, in the real estate, the traditional real estate world, trying to create like class B and C industrial or office or retail, and they're just trying to hit some, you know, number metrics that line up with a spreadsheet, and there's not really a uniqueness to a property. It's just it pans out, right? So why did you target the whole idea of uniqueness versus, you know, just trying to create down and dirty, numerically sound properties?
So I think unique stays are very numerically sound as well. And I think there is this perceived risk that is not reality when it comes to these properties. I really do believe that. It's like they're different, so therefore perceived as risky, whereas in reality, they're less risky because they're different, right? Like if 1,000 rooms come online in Fredericksburg, you know who's going to get hammered? The La Quinta and the Red Roof Inn, not Onera, right? Not to the same extent, because people aren't, you know, going to the level that we're going and investing in the units to the same extent. So that's, I think, a bit of a misnomer. And the numbers jumped off the page for me before we even built Onera, right? There were these, you know, cool but not earth-shattering unique Airbnbs that were doing, you know, it was a couple's stay, maybe 300 to 400, maybe 500 square feet, that were doing over $100,000 a year. And I was like, can I be better than them? I think so. Can I do something more novel than them? I think so. And therefore, you know, maybe I can beat those numbers. And I mean, we're doing over $200,000 per on a similar sized unit at some of our unique stays, like the Monarch Treehouse and Live Oak Lodge. Some of the our nicer, more novel units are doubling what I initially saw and underwrote. So yeah, I think it's less risky, if anything. I think what's more risky is going into a market that's getting a ton of supply coming online and throwing in a commodity. To me, that's much more risky, and that's where you're going to get burned.
So you talked about a lot of supply coming in onto the market, and I know the biggest thing that a lot of real estate bears like to talk about is that there's a glut of Airbnbs that are on the market. Do you think that's your moat against an Airbnb recession, that your properties are unique versus, you know, just that random 2-bedroom that's in a major metro area that is middle of the road for a review?
So make no mistake, there is a glut of Airbnbs, and specifically there's a glut of commodity undifferentiated Airbnbs like you're speaking to. And I think that there's going to continue to be consolidation and compression of margins, the more supply that comes online. So yes, I certainly think that our competitive moat, it's twofold. It's we're willing to spend to make one of a kind units, and we're not as concerned with the P&L. Or sorry, we're not as concerned with the cost per key. We are highly concerned with the P&L and the yield. So our return on cost is 15 to 20%. Find me another asset class in commercial real estate that can consistently deliver 15 to 20% yield on cost. You know, it's few and far between. So we believe in that side of things much more than we do cost per key. And then there's also the special sauce on our side of we're relentlessly focused on the customer and what they want, right? What the guest wants. And that's shareability. It's these one-of-a-kind experiences. And then it comes down to how do we best reach them and connect with them? And we found that's on Instagram and social media more broadly. And we can create highly engaging content that captivates our audience and helps them to feel connected to our property and evokes an emotion. So we evoke an emotion. They're high basically on Instagram, right? Scrolling through these videos that then they're getting this dopamine rush. They come across Onera. We provide some amazing, captivating content. They get a dopamine rush and they say, I have to stay there. I have to take my partner there, right? And they go to the booking site and they don't care if it's $600 or $850. And it's an enjoyable experience all the way through. And they're happy to sort of give us their money so that we can collaborate with them on creating this one-of-a-kind experience. So that's how we think about designing our spaces. So they have to show well on social media. They have to, you know, video and photograph well. And that's some of the things that we've learned with our past properties. Monarch and Spyglass, two of our most acclaimed units at Onera Fredericksburg. Monarch is shaped like a butterfly. It's kind of offset and double peaked roof. From the inside, it's actually very hard to shoot. It's hard to show you the grandiosity and how amazing these vaulted ceilings look in the bedroom, but also the cool kind of overhanging hammock that's in the living room because of the way it's cut up. So now when we design spaces, we design for the shoot through moment. So you can see the unit in all of its glory in one shot. So that's something that we've learned, right? And that's just one example of many learnings that we get throughout the process. So we're constantly improving our designs so they're optimized for this new age of shareability.
We have consolidated our office portfolio, which is very much a tough sector of the market. And what we found is very similar, that unique properties, unique experiences are the only thing that folks want to do to come into the office, right? Nobody wants to go into that Class B office and sit there and grind from 9 to 5. But I'm fascinated by creating a shoot-through process for a unique experience. How do you work with an architecture firm to do that?
Today, actually, I'm doing a lot of the concepting myself, like early stages, getting some marketing materials, getting some renderings, and then we'll work with an architect that is willing to collaborate on the vision. That's one thing that we've had to work through. Like, it's not easy to find the architect that can deliver plans in a timely fashion and that are also highly willing to collaborate. So those are the two things that we filter for in a big way. But the answer is that I'm doing a lot of the upfront concepting because we know what guests want and we've seen it. And I mean, that shoot through moment's as simple as, instead of, you know, having these two double peaked roof separated rooms of Monarch farther apart, so you can only catch the doorway of the bedroom from the living room and vice versa, smush them together a bit more so you can actually see, you know, 80% of the bedroom while you're shooting the living room. So it's those kind of simple tweaks so that if I'm a photographer and videographer, I know I can get a better shot. And I have videographers in-house. We have tons of photographers we work with. We have other content creators we work with. And we're constantly getting their feedback and how can we make these units better. So I'm asking my videographer, what can I do on the design side to make your job easier and make this unit pop?
So how did you guys start the process of working with content creators? Because I think for a lot of the, I hate to throw the B word out there, but boomer investors that I work with, many of them don't understand how the process of content creation works at all. So how do you facilitate working with an investor or working with, you know, just your firm alone the process of starting to work with content creators?
So, another area of improvement that I had when I started was this very thing. So I don't know if I'd ever sent a DM on Instagram, right? I was not very into social media. I might as well have been a boomer myself. And we launched on Airbnb and we were doing great revenues on Airbnb. I had an influencer reach out to me on Airbnb and say, hey, can we do a collab? Can I do a giveaway post? And I'm like, I don't even have a direct website. And I didn't want any bookings that were coming through this Instagram post to then get fed to Airbnb so they can, you know, make their 17% on me and the guest. So we spun up a direct booking website and it was mediocre at best, but we got something up and running. And I had that influencer come out and her handle is Texas Explorer, name's Amanda, and she is fantastic. I mean, she's blown up too. She had a couple hundred thousand followers when we worked with her. Now she's close to a million, like 2 years later. And she is known across Central Texas as like, you know, one of, if not the best. And she did about 25 to 30 grand in direct bookings for us across two posts in 1 month. So, you know, that was what I needed to see and know to say, okay, I need to invest in this area. But initially that first year, it was me fielding inbound from influencers and content creators and tapping Amanda for some advice because she was graciously willing to give me some advice along the way as I was learning. So I learned a bit of it myself. It was, you know, probably 30 minutes or so of my time a week. It wasn't this massive investment, but I did start to learn over time. And in that first year, we did about 30% direct. Now, I will say Onera was a one of a kind product and it was very well suited for social media. So if the product I was selling hadn't been Onera, it might have been a much harder lift to get up the curve of social media and understand the value. So I totally recognize that. In 2022, we did 30%. That was our first full year, 30% direct bookings. In 2023, we tried to double down by hiring an agency. Now, we haven't had the best experience with agencies. They're showing you a lot of, you know, views and impressions and, you know, likes and followers. And I'm like, I care about direct booking revenue, right? Followers is great. I mean, it's a vanity metric. If it leads to bookings, cool. But there was nothing, you know, even projected or considered on their side in terms of bookings. And that's what led us to build the team internally. So we now have a content and marketing team that is about, I think it's actually now bigger than the rest of my team. So more than half of our 13 or 14 or so person team at Owasi, the corporate level, more than half the team is content and marketing. So we have videographers, we have copywriters, we have creative, we have social media managers, we have all these people, right? And as I mentioned before, my co-founder, Jesse, who runs that team. And, you know, we've just seen how valuable that can be on all facets, right? It's valuable for my personal brand, for bringing in leads, for building in public and creating this fan base for our future hotels, for investors, for lead generation. You know, people see what we've done with Onera. And now they see what we've done with other properties that we manage for. So we started sharing the results that we're achieving for other properties. And, you know, they've given us permission to do that. And we now have gotten a bunch of lead generation of folks that want us to help them market their properties as well. So I will say, if you are a business owner trying to hire a firm to help you with social media, content marketing, and digital marketing more broadly, be very conscious of the types of metrics they're using and if those align with your values and what you want to get out of the relationship. Because very few, if any, agencies that I've seen show the metrics that typically matter to a business owner. And that's one of our pitches as a social media and digital marketing team more broadly, is we are owners. So we know how owners think, and those are the KPIs and metrics that we're going to hold ourselves to and that we're going to present to you. It's direct bookings. It's, you know, conversions. Impressions matter because, you know, that leads to conversions. So and then ultimately dollars.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. I found that for us in our podcast, we get a lot of clicks off of YouTube. And a YouTube view is worth a certain metric of clicks. But a Facebook or a particularly Twitter view of the same video is worth almost nothing. And so I can only imagine what an agency would sell you trying to say, look at how many views are on X video on Twitter. And it has very little bearing in metric versus another platform. So in terms of trying to find value, I was curious, how do you go about targeting properties? Because I think there's such a struggle to find uniqueness or whatever that je ne sais quoi is in the real estate space. How do you find unique properties, particularly properties that then pencil?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question because I no longer go out there and buy pre-existing unique stays, right? Because to me, it's a little bit of like square peg in a round hole, because I'm trying to take what's already been built and optimize it for shareability, when alternatively, I can just build it from scratch and optimize it for shareability and make it that much more Instagrammable and, you know, ensure that I'm going to blow guests away and ensure that, you know, it's going to be a novel, unique design. So, yeah, people may not like to hear that, but you can certainly control a lot more and ensure uniqueness if you build from scratch. Now, when it comes to property, that is something that I'm pretty passionate about in terms of how to pick the right property for, let's say, a unique stay or landscape hotel. And we have this new criteria that we use when picking properties. And that is, if we bring somebody to the site, or like when I go to the site for the first time, I or the person I'm bringing needs to have an autonomic response that they whip out their phone to take a photo or video because the view is so amazing, or the forest is so enchanting, or the river or whatever the water feature is so enticing. So that's one, you know, metric and thing that we think about in terms of properties. I'm becoming less constrained by, oh, it has to be near a major market or a major attraction. I believe the property itself can be an attraction if the views are that amazing and the product, the property you're building, is, you know, that sort of shareable and one of one. And we've seen that at Onera. So at Onera Fredericksburg is one of the top driving destinations in Central Texas. It's a very cute pioneer vibes town with a lot of cute shops and great food and a number of museums. And it's got this amazing state park, Enchanted Rock, that's very nearby. And we time and time again see guests that are coming to Onera and just hanging out the whole time in their little treehouse with their loved one. You know, we have a pool area and a communal elevated deck that's tucked into a live oak tree grove. So there's some things to do, but I mean, it's not even to the extent of the amenities and resort things that we're going to have at Owasi Hill Country, my next project, which will have, you know, a spa, a gym, a restaurant, you know, a bigger event space. And even without all that, guests are choosing to stay on site and experience Onera over, you know, going to Fredericksburg. So to me, that's pushed me to, you know, look at other locations that have incredible property, like better property I could ever find, that might be next to a town or a city or some attraction, but it's still very easy driving distance from these major markets that have considerable wealth. So Owasi Hill Country is an hour from Austin. It's an hour from San Antonio, a few hours from Houston. So you can still pull from all those markets. And when they see it on Instagram, they're not like, oh, you know, I'm only going to go to it if it's in Fredericksburg. They're like, wow, those views are incredible. That's only an hour away from me. I'm going to go.
So when we're talking about trying to pull from those markets, who would you say is your target demographic? Because I saw a recent post, and I believe it was Wall Street Journal or it might have been Fortune, that Gen Z and younger millennials, that their target focus is where they spend their wealth isn't long-term investing, it's experiences. And that's ultimately what you're selling, right? So would you say your demographic skews younger, or are you getting just generally across the board?
I think our core demographic is probably 25 to 55. You'd be surprised at the number of 55 and older, even 60, 65 and older that we get at Onera. So it's certainly not, exclusive in that way to the younger generation. But it does skew that way. We talk about this person as more of an archetype of consumer, which is the modern traveler. Okay. And the modern traveler cares about shareability. They care about one-of-a-kind experiences. They want to collaborate with the property and the team and sort of have this, you know, warm experience with the founder or with the site manager, you know, whoever is there, and get away from this transactional type experience that I was talking about before with hotels, where, you know, you go to the check-in desk, you wait in line, they ask you how your day was because they're paid to do so, and the whole thing just feels like a transaction. So the more that we can collaborate, the more aligned we are with the modern traveler. And, you know, they're the person that's doing the fun, cool stuff that the other people in the friend group ask them, oh, where should I go? You know, if I want to, you know, have a fun experience with maybe a new romantic partner or an anniversary or something like that. Like, they're the person that their friend group goes to ask for that advice. They are posting on social about the experiences that they're having. You know, maybe they're going to Burning Man, Coachella. You know, maybe they have a Tesla or an Apple Watch. So they're tech forward, and they are, you know, in some ways a trendsetter and an authority, even if it's just in their small friend group, of what the, you know, exciting new novel experiences are that are out there.
I think one of the things that's novel for some of the real estate folks that are listening, and I would say probably 80% of the podcasts are real estate investors or brokers. In terms of our audience, one of the things that we've been moving towards is the idea of real estate, and that could be hospitality or residential or commercial industrial, is ultimately becoming more of a service. And I know that you have, you know, restaurant startups like Chick-fil-A, and by startup, I mean many years ago, where they primarily reached out to originally when they were establishing their brand was this idea of trying to find hospitality and hospitality groups to teach them how to interact with the employee and how to interact with the employee to teach them how to interact like it's a home or a long-term high-quality experience with their customer. So when you're going about that process of teaching the employee how to deal with the customer and how to create that warm experience, how did you guys go about doing that? Because the employee's boots on the ground, not necessarily as trained as you would expect social media posts to be. How do you get that experience out of that boots on the ground employee when the customer rolls in at 2 a.m?
Yeah, so I can tell you how we do it today. I will say that we are constantly trying to improve in this area. We don't come from 5-star, you know, Michelin rated hospitality. That's not my background. So we're actually getting coaching and, you know, bringing hospitality consultants in to try to learn, okay, what are the good things that these folks know? Because I do think there is incredible things to learn from some of the top hospitality restaurants and hotels and spaces in the world. How we think about it is, how do we communicate and share the vision of what we're trying to do and enroll people in that vision? So that includes our, you know, the people that we hire. How do we get them excited about innovating hospitality for the modern traveler, about creating these shareable one-of-a-kind experiences, about collaborating with guests instead of transacting? So because I share about this stuff all the time, even if, you know, in some cases we get leads through LinkedIn or through Twitter, where I post pretty actively, or through the newsletter. And even if we don't, let's say we get referred somebody through a staffing agency or through an Indeed post, typically they're going to look up the company. They're going to see a bunch of podcasts that I've been on talking about this stuff, and they're going to see if their values align with what we're trying to do and if that excites them. And if, you know, they're going to enroll themselves in this mission. So I think that's a big piece of it, that we have an advantage because I'm very out there and sharing this, so people know what we're about. So I think that's one thing. Another piece of it is we've had to considerably increase our salaries, you know, in our budgets too. So we want a to some extent, a limited, very efficient staff. So we want fewer people, but the people that we have, we want to be exceptional. So in order to get exceptional people, you got to pay them more. We do on-site housing. So they have, you know, a housing solution we can pull from a broader pool. And then if they're also enrolled in the vision, like if we have all those things to offer, place to stay, an inspiring property, you know, for free, a very competitive, if not, you know, high salary for the role. And then we're also enrolling you in this very compelling, exciting vision. Then I believe you can really get a rock star. And that's what we're after. And that's, you know, that's what we've found as of late. And in the beginning, it wasn't that way, right? When I opened Onera, I was not all over the internet talking about this stuff. It was extraordinarily hard to hire. We didn't have on-site housing. We were trying to get people for cheap. So I've really had to come along, and the companies had to come a long way in that department. But now we are just seeing incredible dividends from investing in our people, communicating the vision broadly, and you know, doing things like offering them housing.
Like, there's a lot of lean and mean groups that we've brought on the podcast, and they have a very similar view in terms of lean but competitive salaries. I know we're getting lean on time here, so I wanted to switch to our final four. And that's a great opportunity where we get to learn a little bit more about you, learn a little bit about more about the business, a little bit more about the future of hospitality. So we're going to go to the future first. What do you think has changed the most about the hospitality industry, and where do you think it's ultimately going?
So I believe that hospitality and hotels specifically have been much more democratized. This idea of hosting, and I think Airbnb is, you know, a big reason for that, right? Like, Airbnb has allowed this whole wave of innovators and entrepreneurs to get into hosting and providing accommodations that otherwise never would have been able to, or never would have thought that they could. And I think that's led to a different way of thinking, which is pushing the bounds of sort of historical wisdom in the hospitality real estate world, which was never true, but it was just never challenged. So I think that's really exciting, and that's happening now. I think you're going to see those same people creating some of the most compelling hospitality and hotel brands moving forward, and brands that you see this insatiable customer loyalty and excitement around, like you would for an Apple, you know, or like you would for some of these, you know, brands that are just relentlessly customer focused, like an Amazon. But just to date, you don't see that level of loyalty to the big brand hotels. The loyalty is there because of the points and the perks. It's not there because they're enrolled in the mission of Marriott and Hilton. So I think that's going to change. And, you know, one thing to note, I mean, I believe that Instagram is going to be the biggest OTA by 2030. It's just a much more enjoyable experience for discovering a travel destination or a place to stay. It's much more enjoyable and euphoric than bargain shopping on booking.com or Airbnb, right? So I think that's another area. You can engage with it. You can see the property from all angles with video, with lifestyle shoots where you can see another person interacting with the space. You might get a little tidbit from the founder or the team that helps you connect with the property in a better way. It's not a static, you know, 20 photos with a uniform description like a lot of these platforms are moving towards.
So I know we've moved towards the future, and I was curious if we could move a step back in time. And when you were starting out in the hospitality industry, where do you think you could have changed something? Like, if you could have told yourself one little tidbit, one little tip, what would it have been?
So two things come to mind. Sorry, it's not one, but don't skimp.
Fine.
Yeah. Don't skimp, and you can't outsource your problems. Like, there's an element of that. So I've tried to outsource, you know, capital raising earlier in my career when I just didn't want to do it, right? It wasn't something I enjoyed. And come to find out, the CEO has to do that, right? So I've had to, you know, and I've come to learn that I'm actually better at it than trying to bring somebody else in, because I understand the business at its core. I can speak to it. I can handle objections. I have, you know, a passion and an insight that bringing somebody else in wouldn't have. So that's one piece. And the same thing for social media, right? We tried to hire an agency, outsource our problems. You know, they didn't care in the same way that we do, and they weren't looking at it from an owner standpoint. So that's one tidbit. And then another one is, yeah, the don't skimp. So tried to cut corners, tried to hustle, tried to be cheap here or there to, you know, lower costs or improve margins. And inevitably, it usually comes back to bite. That's been my experience. You know, China, I gave that example earlier. That was a prime example of that, right? I think I could have leveled up in the short-term rental world if I wasn't cheap earlier on. I think I maybe could have built a brand sooner, better performing properties. The returns you get on the final design and amenities and like the additional, call it the last like 5 to 10% of spend, has the highest returns of the whole thing. So it's like, why are you going to, when it comes to development, buy the land, pour the pad, you know, get the plans, do the utilities, do all this stuff, and then like, you know, stop at the 90% mark, right? And do, you know, half the revenue that you would do if you actually put in that last bit of investment. So I learned that over the years. And, you know, we really try to embody that in all the always, as well as hiring. So it's like, you can't skimp on hiring either. We were talking about competitive salaries, and, you know, we have a very robust hiring process. We hire slowly to make sure we get good people. I don't just hire somebody because we have a need to fill the hole. You know, I think that's pretty short-sighted. We wait to get the right person. So I think those are some initial tidbits that if I internalized them earlier, I probably would have had success earlier.
So I want to double back on one of the things you mentioned. So we always talk about in the office world, as well as even the multi-tenant industrial world, that there are three places you can take an L, and that's lobby, landscaping, and then you can go about and really take an L if you go ahead and you screw up the lot, the parking lot. So I'm curious, where are those ultimate value adds when you're talking about getting and maximizing a property in that last 10 or 15%?
So it's definitely the things that guests see, feel, you know, touch, smell, whatever. It's like, it's that those last things that are going to show up on the videography and photography, right? It's the first thing they see when they enter the property. So, you know, for us, we spend quite a bit on finishes. We spend quite a bit on furniture, a lot more than I used to. And I think you can really see the difference, right? So many short-term rental operators are buying the same stuff, like even West Elm. Like West Elm's not cheap, but it's kind of, it's a cookie cutter way of delivering where you could spend a little bit more and get amazing custom furniture, which is in a lot of cases, like, you know, has a better warranty or, you know, going to last longer. So, you know, I think those are a couple examples. And then on the architecture and design front, I mean, obviously that's up front. That's not at the end, but making those decisions early of like, yeah, we're going to cantilever the hot tub 25 feet in the air, even though it weighs 300 pounds, and we're going to spend, you know, 30 grand more on structural steel because we're going to be the only game in town that has that offering that can get that shot. So, and I think that's where the, you know, idea of, oh, you know, maybe this is risky comes into play, but I think it's actually the competitive moat that is mitigating risk, that somebody else isn't doing that and that they can't get that shot and that you're the only game in town. So,
well, podcasts aren't the only game in town to learn a little bit more and get additional insight on the world. And one of the ways that we like to provide our guests with a little bit more information is a book recommendation. So I'm curious, is there a book that our listeners should be reading, ideally about the hospitality industry, but it could be just about life in general?
Yeah, you know, I got to admit, I listen mostly to podcasts. I get a lot of my, I was doing audiobooks for a bit there, but for me, it's, I mean, one book that I read when I was a teenager, and I think I read maybe once again in my 20s, and I haven't read it since, but I remember a lot of the things in there, and that was How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, my dad gave me that book when I was a kid, and I think it can help in any realm of business, any realm of life, and, you know, hospitality is certainly one of them, right? How do you sort of make people feel special and important and all those things? I think it's, you know, as important, if not more, in hospitality than many other businesses.
Look, I'm never going to sleep on Dale Carnegie. So In terms of the most important question of the podcast, though, it's simply the whole reason for the podcast, and it's who should come on next, because we find that the men in the arena who are working at and in a field really know who the best voices are to talk to. So, Ben, what's your recommendation?
It's a good question. Have you had Isaac on? He's a good buddy of mine.
So we have not, and we should definitely bring him on. Can you tell us a little bit about Isaac?
Yeah, Isaac founded Live Oak Lake. It is a experiential landscape hotel in Waco, and we're good buddies. I view him as a contemporary and a colleague in this world of experiential hospitality. He's hosted me and my wife for our anniversary. We've hosted him and his wife. And I think that he's got a very unique perspective, and we agree on a lot, but I think he even thinks certain things are more important than I do, and vice versa. So I think he has an interesting, unique perspective that would be valuable for hospitality real estate folks.
Look, we'd love to have him on. And there's one final question we have to ask you, and it's also pretty darn important. What's the best way that someone who's listening today can reach out to you?
Yeah, so I'm very active on LinkedIn, Ben Wolf, 2 F's. And Twitter as well. So at Unique Stays Guy, you can find me there. That's where I think Gordon found me. Either of those places, you can sign up for my newsletter. I share on this stuff weekly, and we post daily, additional insights and experiences.
Ben, thank you so much for hopping on today.
Thanks, Gordon.
Thanks again to Ben. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a follow, a review. All your interactions matter, and they help us get great guests. You can follow us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.